doorstep.
Oh, yes. BJ, love this more.
When I was in elementary school, like my voice changed really, really early. And when I would go see some of my father's friends, some of the women would just ask me to talk. Because they thought that my voice sounded really nice because of the way it resonated. And so they would be like, Peter, just say something.
This is creepy. Yeah.
Especially because I was like 7 or 8.
Auditory molestation.
Yes. So, anyway, on to Magical Grid. I don't get that right. But, so, the first thing that is not a grade is the probationary grade. You get a lot of people who are just like, oh, the probationers, this is the first grade of the AA, right? No, you're not actually in as a probationer. And that's important for certain elements of magical politics, but we're not going to get into that. But as a probationer, you do not have an actual AA grade. You are not a member of the AA. You have no authority. And you can see that by the fact that there is no magical weapon associated with the grade of the probationer. And there's not much that they actually do. Like, they kind of explore and look at the AA stuff and figure out if they want to join and whether or not the AA wants them. When you go with kind of the mythos of the Rosicrucians, there's this idea that you have an opportunity that will knock once when you are ready, and the teacher will appear to you and say, do you wish to be a Rosicrucian? And if you say yes, you can be. If you say no, it will never happen again. And that's kind of what they go for a little bit with what the probationer is. It's this point where the opportunity comes knocking, but everyone realizes that in reality, you probably shouldn't just make a snap judgment on that. And if you are going to make a snap judgment on that, we don't want you, and the teacher probably shouldn't make a snap judgment on the student either. So in the original AA structure, there was actually a required period of time in which people had to be probationers before being allowed to actually join the AA. Now Crowley played fast and loose with all of his own roles, so who knows what actually happened. But yes. Now, in the Golden Dawn, they did it a little differently with their neophyte grade, where you actually did have an initiation, and you did actually have work that you did, but it was basically like a subgrade to the other Earth grade, the Zealoter. And the whole idea was that you were entering into the grade work. So we're not really going to talk much about that, because it's not as cool as the neophyte grade, where you actually are doing work, and actually are in the AA, and actually have a weapon. So that relates to the sphere of Earth, which we've kind of talked about a lot there is our example sphere, that you're dealing with the idea of touch and physical sensation and observing the actual physical nature of things and understanding the universe purely through physical manifestation. And the reason for that is that Earth relates to the concepts of stability, manifestation, and reflection. The Order of the Celestial Academy actually uses a shield instead of a pentacle. For the symbol of Earth, because their idea is that the shield reflects off force. You hit a shield and the force bounces off of the shield, and it's kind of a re-manifestation of the force.
They don't cite the shields and swords very much, do they?
No. Mm-hmm. And the idea there is that when you take the black soil of Malkuth, like the rich manifesting field in which things can grow, that forms the kingdom of the physical world. And you put things into it, things grow up out of it. And so you have this ability for growth and manifestation and birth. It's kind of like this kind of concept of motherhood, in a sense. It's Mother Earth. But in addition to that, you also have this fixation on the idea of stability. When you create the pentacle, you are etching your concept of the universe into this physical disc, which when finished is basically like a little rock. And so you've created this form, firm, stable form at that point. You're also dealing with the idea of what is manifest versus what is not manifest. You deal with the concepts of creation and destruction here, and understanding that while the world is this stable reality, you have to be able to understand and control that stability and break it down or apply it as needed. And so your magical work is one of saying, okay, this is the way that things are. This is the why. This is why things are this way, and this is what holds it up and makes it remain this way. So I'm going to pull away the things that make it remain this way, so everything's stable and mutable, and I can change it now. And now that I've changed it, I'm going to put back into place these things that hold it in place and make it remain the way it is. And you're dealing with that concept of what form and change are in the level of Earth, and kind of understanding that the whole nature of everything that you're dealing with in the universe is one that you're going to experience through your body. And so the part of the soul that relates to the sphere of Earth and Asiya is the guf, or the body. Each sphere is understanding unity in a different way. And here you're understanding unity through touch and interaction. So if everybody had a big group hug, then you would understand the unity of the group through the big group hug. That's probably the easiest way to explore that. How many people here have had any connection with punk rock back when punk rock was still punk rock?
A little.
So you guys understand that hitting people can be a way of understanding that you're connected to those people and that you're sharing together, and that it's a way of growing and loving.
Could ask the same question about BDSM.
Except that I've never done that. I've done the punk rock version. So it's something that, like, people who haven't experienced that have trouble understanding, that you can have this physical collision, and the point of the physical collision is to understand that you're not alone, that you're connected to other things, and that you share in the physicality of those things. But that really is a lot of the mystery that you're developing there. So old school punk rockers who mosh are all neophytes. The Zealoter grade is the next grade. It's the grade of air and relates to the intellect, the sphere of Yesod. Everything that you deal with words, thoughts, definitions, all of that is tied up in that grade. All of the mysteries of that grade relate to understanding those processes and the underlying nature of those processes. One of the things that I like with that grade is that it takes away all of the stuff about, like, I don't want to be labeled. I don't want people to think of me as this or that, because you begin to understand how labels actually work. The people will say, like, well, I don't want to say I'm a Thelemite because that's pigeonholing myself, and then people are going to think of me as the way they think of other Thelemites, and, well, maybe I have these other ideas and I'm not just a Thelemite. It's like, that's fine. No one says you can only have one label. Like, the process of labeling and defining things is one by which you cut away at everything that is not the thing. And that's what you're dealing with in air, is separation. This is the sphere of the dagger. So one way you can think of it is like an artist with a chisel. The artist has a big hunk of rock, and the artist with his chisel reveals what's inside the hunk of rock. He recognizes that this rock has within it the potential to have the form of a really beautiful lion. And so with his chisel, he cuts away everything that is not that beautiful lion, so that he's now defined the rock into the lion. It's not just one chisel stroke that does that. It's a whole bunch of different chisel strokes that define it into everything that it is. With just one chisel stroke, all you have is a cut rock. So that's the mystery that you deal with when you deal with the mysteries of air, is the idea that through separating things out and making them individual and recognizing the specific direction in which the thing travels, that you are able to understand the thing more fully. And in understanding the thing more fully and understanding the separation between the two things, you're able to understand the way in which they come together. In looking at the space between things and the negative space, you understand how that space defines the actual things that are interacting with each other, and that their interaction is based on the fact that they're separate, and the way in which they interact is the way in which you're able to understand them through their separateness. I remember when undergoing that degree that I would drive around places and just look at things and be like, wow, this is how much is in between them. And that's what, like, makes them whole. And, like, we get really, like, intensely into, like, looking at negative space. And it was like, no one had quite described it to me that way. It was just like talking about like, okay, you're going to define things by separating them out and thinking about the ideas of things and the words you use to describe them. And it was just this kind of natural thing where it's like, well, if I'm cutting everything away, well, there's all this stuff that's left when you cut it away. And it becomes really important to understanding everything when you're dealing with that. If you think about the nature of a definition, then that's what a definition is doing. When I was a kid, there used to be these little toys where you had a field of colors, and then you had a plastic sheet, and the plastic sheet had black outlines on it. And when you opened it up, you couldn't tell what the picture was. It was just like a bunch of pretty colors. And then you put the sheet over it, and the pretty sheet had the outlines that lined up with the colors, and it showed you what the picture was. And that's kind of how the process of creation works a little bit, too. In the sphere of water, you've got all the pretty colors and all the things that associate and bleed together. But then in the sphere of air, you define them and cut them away so that you have a rigid direction that shows where these things go and what it is that they are and what it is that they mean. If you think about understanding anything on an intellectual level, if you think in terms of a picture of the thing, you're still thinking of the thing on a physical level. If you think of things in terms of the way it feels, you're still thinking of it at a physical level. If you think of something in the words that you use to describe what it is, then you're thinking of things on the level of air and the level of the intellect. So a book can be something where it has a hard edge, it's kind of rectangular, and it has kind of a sort of combination of smoothness and roughness on the paper, but the outside is smooth. And you're thinking of it purely physically at that point. And if when you think of a book, you're thinking of the way the book feels in your hands and what it feels like to move through the pages, you're thinking at a physical level. If you think of a book as a piece of board that has pieces of paper that have been cut and are glued together and has words printed on the pages, then you're thinking of a book in terms of the definition of a book. And in terms of what the actual intellectual concept of a book is at that point. And when you look at the difference there, the physical manifestation deals much more with what you actually experience. The intellectual manifestation deals much more with the specificity of the thing. Lots of things can be rectangles that you can open up that have different types of textures that you can touch. Not lots of things can be two pieces of board that have sheets of paper glued inside and things printed on them. And that's the nature of the experience of unity through the realm of air, is that you're experiencing it through the way in which you can define something out and it being so specific and individual that you're at the very tip of the dagger's point and everything is hewn and honed down into that single piece where you understand the core idea of what that thing is. Not the core nature of its being, not the core experience of the thing, but the core idea of what the thing is. In the Grade of Practicus, you deal with water. And part of the soul for that grade is the ruach, or the intellect, which is the breath and the spirit and the mind. The Practicus, however, you're dealing with water. And so here you have kind of the amorphous fluid movement of everything, that you're kind of beginning to deal with the world in much more broad concepts. Spyware scanner. And it didn't like that. It wants the world to be rigid and defined. Here you're dealing with water and air, you start dealing with elements that are much more esoteric in their nature, to the point where on some level the water and air the water and fire, you're dealing with more esoteric elements, to the point where the water and fire are almost the same in a lot of ways. Both of them are dealing with different types of dissolution and unity, where the unities that you're dealing with in earth and air are unities based on the separation of things. In water and fire, you're dealing with unities that are based on traditional concepts of unity. question.
I was just thinking, I mean, you have air and meeting fire. You have fire often is considered a point of considered action.
Mm-hmm.
Air is thought.
Mm-hmm.
The process of action and thought together are in Latin decidere, or decide,
mm-hmm.
literally cutting away. In
yes.
German, it's entscheiden, literally cutting away,
mm-hmm.
taking away, like boom. And I never really thought of the two fitting. I know I went, okay, here's a definition. Oh,
mm-hmm.
it's like, okay, to cut away.
Well, if you put them together, you basically have the Platonic concept of masculinity, and they're the two masculine elements. Which is probably why Plato had that concept of masculinity in the first place. But maybe it's the reverse. Who knows?
Conflict of the real and the ideal.
Mm-hmm. And so with the practicus, you're dealing with water. So you've got, think about pouring water out and pouring water out from different sources. Water's all going to flow together and it's all going to kind of combine. And you're not necessarily going to be able to completely tell which source is which purely. Even if you have a bunch of different colored waters or slightly different weighted liquids, they're going to still kind of blend together and interact in ways in which they're changed and they're not fully separable again. And what you're dealing with in knowing things through that level of water is you're dealing with associations and emotions and memory. And if you think of something in terms of happiness, there could be like a million things that fall under happiness. There could be a million things that fall under sadness or under anger or hatred or kindness. You're dealing with things that are much more conceptual in nature, but they're still things that are manifest, clear concepts that you're able to understand and recognize. And so what you're looking at here is not so much that this concept is this thing in a one-to-one relationship, but that this concept or this thing is a manifestation of the nature of this concept. And this concept has a whole bunch of things that share in that nature. So if you look at, like a good example of this is the color red. Red deals with a certain emotional spectrum in terms of the underlying instinctual reactions to the color red. Now, when you actually express things that are related and associated to the color red, you could have happiness going with red, you could have love going with red, you can have anger going with red, you can have hatred going with red, war falls under Gevura, which is red.
Mm-hmm.
They're all pretty similar.
Yes, the concepts
mm-hmm.
are all basically the same, even though the experience of the given emotion differs based on the scenario. But they all go back to a sense of excitement and kind of an elevated, stimulated state of being. Whereas if you have the color blue, then you might have languor or rest. You could have kind of idleness. Those are all much more clearly the same. But they're all things where you're dealing with more of a kind of lack of motion or a toned down, unstimulated sense of being. And so you wouldn't necessarily say red is happiness, but you might say happiness relates to the color red, or happiness can be represented by the color red. And if you look at a lot of the ways in which people do imagery related to different emotions, you will see some consistency to the colors that people use when dealing with certain emotional concepts. And so you're kind of dealing with things in that kind of not really a representative sense, but a symbolic sense, where you're dealing with how certain types of vibrations and certain types of stimulus call together certain types of memories and certain types of emotions here. And a lot of what people associate with magical ritual really comes down to this level, where you're saying, okay, the scent of this incense, even though the incense itself is an airy thing, the scent stimulates emotions and memories, which you use to call to mind certain different types of experiences and forces, and then tie into those in order to apply for your magical purpose. When you burn a candle of a given color, there's one explanation for it is that that color vibrates in a given way, and so it's releasing the energy that's related to that vibration. Another way that you can explore the idea is that that color relates to certain feelings and emotions and memories within yourself, and you're able to use those to tap into the part of the universe that relates to that same current of force, and then draw that current of force forth based on that, that interaction. And so what you're dealing with in the practicus grade is understanding the world through all of these associations, all of these things that go together. Chris once said in a class that he taught that gematria is the practice of a good practicus. Do you remember saying that, Chris? Because I remember you saying that.
It was. It sounds like something.
Yes. It sounds like a Chrisism. And it is. Gematria is, for anyone not familiar, is Jewish numerology. But it's not Greek numerology, because that's isocephia. Yes. And so the idea is that the underlying vibration that's represented by the word is created from the vibrational forces that are built into the letters of the word, and that the numbers corresponding to the letter therefore carry with it that same kind of like vibrational nature. So you have a coalescence of all these vibrations into this given vibration or concept that's represented by this number. And so everything else that shares that number is going to share in that same nature, because you have a bunch of things coalescing that are vibrating with the same numerical value. And so the value or nature of the things have something that links them up. And so you're able to kind of meditate or explore this interaction of seemingly disparate things based on their sameness through their word or their name. But it only works with Hebrew, because Hebrew is close enough to the language that God used to create the universe. At least if you're getting into like really Jewish teachings on gematria. The same thing can be done with practical Kabbalah, which is more of what I've been talking about, where you go through and you say, okay, this color relates to this sphere on the tree of life, and all of these different things kind of relate or associate with this color, so these things all relate back to this sphere of the tree of life, so they all share in a certain given unity that way. And you can begin to understand them more deeply through that, by understanding the concepts that relate to that tree, and that part of the tree. And so that's what you're exploring with the sphere of the practicus. The weapon there is the cup, because the cup holds things together. It's the weapon of gestation, in which you put together all of your disparate parts and you make your soup through them. So you have unity through mixation. You don't actually dissolve things in the cup. The cup just holds things together that still have a certain level of individuality, but they're connected by all being held together in the cup. The part of the soul is the nefesh. The nefesh is often thought of as your evil impulse or your animal principle, and it has an element of that. The nefesh is related to the spirit, but not the soul. And it's not purely negative, but it's related in somewhat to your impulses, because it relates to kind of an unrefined connectivity and this idea of association. And so you have one thing that leads to another thing, and you want to kind of jump to that other thing. And so that's where you get this impulse-driven nature of the nefesh, and that it's very tied up in emotionality. And people often think of emotionality as part of your base animal nature, even though it's actually one of your higher functioning elements. And so that's where kind of the negative view of the nefesh comes from. Then, we're almost there at the end now, you have the grade of the philosophus, which relates to fire. And one of the curious things about the philosophus grade, at least in the AA, is it's like the only one where Crowley actually gives sort of a magical yogic principle that relates to it. It's the grade of devotion. And the part of this that what you're dealing with here is the actual soul itself. In Atzilut, or the world of fire, you actually have things truly dissolved together. You can think of it kind of like a forge, where you take all of the different things that you could experience in the universe, and you break them down to the core element or core piece of them, and they exist in this kind of almost fluid molten state where they can run together, and the way in which they're running through and the way in which they're moving is what defines them apart from all the other things there. So everything that moves along in a different given course of action is moving along within the same unity. But all of the different courses of action all move together in order to create the overarching pool of primordial stuff within the forge. And this is, to some degree, where you get this concept of devotion, because you're getting to where you have the pure initial core motion of a thing that the thing is created by and that the thing is devoted to. But you also have the sense that all of these other things which are acting and moving in the same fashion, you're going to be cleaving to when you're dealing with things in this level, because your action and their action are shared, so you essentially are moving within the same nature and are kind of tied up together in a sense there. And so there's a level of that tied in with the devotion. As Lance pointed out, though, this is not motion in the way that the dagger has motion. This is motion in all directions, moving out without any kind of focus. To say that can be a little bit misleading, because it's the nature of the motion that you're dealing with here, not where the motion is going, but what it is that the motion actually does. So, like, in the sense of a brick, in the sphere of Asiya, or in the earth, a brick is a porous, rough-edged, rough-surfaced rectangle. In the sphere of Yetzirah, or of the intellect, a brick is a hunk of clay which has been carved out into a rectangle used for the purposes of building things. In the world of Briah, or of the emotions, the brick is hard, the brick is red, the brick is pointy, and so you associate it with all kinds of things related to those experiences. And you also associate the brick with things in which you've experienced bricks. So the brick could relate to comfort, because homes are made of bricks and homes are comfortable places. And if you think of the stability that the brick provides, it makes sense that the brick would relate to comfort in that point. Stability is where you begin to get into the brick in the world of fire. That the action of the brick is one of being firm and stable and kind of holding things up. So the essential nature of the brick in that world is purely what the brick does, nothing else from the brick. Now, the thing with that is, in order to really explore those ideas, you have to explore them through all of the other senses and through the way in which you experience the other parts of the four worlds, because you're not going to be able to express an action unless you just put the brick there and allow people to observe how the brick acts. But you can understand the thing through the action. The concepts of parents are a good one for understanding action. You can look at your actual mother as your mother in Asiya, and the concept of motherhood in the physical world for you. You can define what a mother is, and that a mother is someone who gives birth to a child and then raises and takes care of that child. You can think of your memories and your emotions associated with your mother in terms of the sphere of Briah, and then all the things that you relate to the concept of motherhood based on those emotions that you relate to your mother. And then you have the actual actions of motherhood within the sphere of Atzilut. So the actual birthing the child, the actual taking care of and guiding the child through life by directing the child. Those are what a mother is in the sphere of Atzilut, as opposed to all the other things that exist in the other spheres. But if you look at it, they're all basically the same thing as you move through the same sphere, because that spark that you identify in Atzilut manifests down through the other spheres in order to create the actual manifestation that you deal with. And that's where the whole process gets into actual practical magic, in the sense that when you identify something in Atzilut and make the change in Atzilut or create a spark of emotion in Atzilut, it manifests through the other four worlds in order to manifest in the world you're experiencing. At Siluth is where you're dealing much more with the actual underlying principles and nature and forces of the universe. And so when you're making changes in those, you're changing things on the level of At Siluth through your actions in Asiyah or Yetzirah. And then through that change that you create in At Siluth, it creates the changes that you experience in the world. The initiatic converse of that is that moving from Asiyah up through At Siluth, you come to understand yourself more purely and understand what it is that your actual nature and movement is. But you don't necessarily understand it fully at that point. You just have kind of the background idea that you're able to then hone in by going through and attaining knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel. The final grade that we would look at is the Dominus Liminus, which is often rendered Lord of the Paths, but actually means Lord of the Threshold. It's the Lord of the Paths in the sense that you are about to enter into the Vault of the Adepts. You have completed all of the elemental work. So these pathways that you've undergone through the elemental work, you are now, you have mastered and are essentially the Lord over those pathways. And you integrate them into yourself fully and integrate them as a unity at that point. And in integrating them as a unity, you recognize the light. And so your weapon is the lamp. And the sort of nature of yourself is simply the divine light. And being exposed to the light as a thing in and of itself outside of an elemental nature at that point. You work on mastering and unifying all of the previous work that you've done and begin preparing yourself to move into the more Rosicrucian mysteries as an adept, which is where the Lord of the Threshold element comes in, that you're about to enter into the vault or enter into the Holy of Holies, and you're standing on the threshold waiting to do so, which is the most dangerous point. You can kind of go crazy doing all of the other stuff by imbalancing yourself elementally. Here, you've balanced yourself and you're fine. But this is also where you can destroy yourself, because you're waiting on the threshold to enter in and find out what it is that you truly are and who you truly are and where you're going and what you need to do. And there is a certain terror to that. And in some of the Rosicrucian mythology and Golden Dawn mythology, they talk about the dweller on the threshold, which is this spiritual force that tries to stop you from moving forward. But it's not the same as all the corruption of the rest of the universe and all the things that you're experiencing that are trying to distract you. This is an actual antagonistic force that's trying to keep you out and keep you from going in. And the thing is that you have the enterer, which is you, as a neophyte. And you're basically becoming a neophyte again as a Dominus Liminus, and so you're the enterer again. And you have the dweller that's there waiting to prevent you to enter. But you are the dweller. They're the same person. It's just all of the things in yourself that would hold you back and cause you to defeat yourself so that you wouldn't enter in and actually engage in the work. Because at this point, you're finished all the stuff that will easily potentially damage you and make you do a lot of the kind of grunt, like, oh, I'm learning all these things and getting all this stuff worked out kind of work. But now you're actually at the point where you're going to take on real responsibility and start doing real work where you're going to have real and major effects. You are basically saying, I am ready to be divine authority in a local sense. I am ready to say that everything which is God, I am going to compress and localize into myself and begin understanding the way in which that unfolds through me, and then instigate and institute the effects of that authority upon the world around me. Yes, and that's why the mysteries of Christ are the mysteries that you deal with here. You are basically becoming Jesus when you do this, in the Gnostic sense of the living Christ, the living Jesus that speaks to everyone and inspires them. That's pretty much the same as your Holy Guardian Angel. And you are working to the point where you develop such a communion with your Holy Guardian Angel that by the end, you give up your Holy Guardian Angel in the sense that you no longer need that illusion of a separate angel talking to you, that you obliterate that sense that there's a separation between you and God, that basically through the Holy Spirit, the Father and the Son become one. And that is the grade structure and the work in a really big nutshell.
How big?
This big. So,